Welcome to Prussian Socialism, bringing you culture, whether you like it or not. I'm here with Roman, and recently Roman wrote an article in the Occidental Observer about Julius Caesar, and he did a very good job explaining the relationship between Julius Caesar and the modern day, or how Caesar might be relevant for us now. So I thought it would be a good episode to do to talk about the article and then, you know, kind of from there branch out more into Caesar's general career, because we've got a couple old episodes I did, I think 2 years ago, that were lectures about Roman history. The first one was about the Punic Wars against Carthage. And then the other one was about the collapse of the Republic, but I didn't take it as far as Caesar. I think I only went up to Marius and Sulla, two of my personal heroes. And, you know, so we can talk about Caesar, and we can get into some of the more, some of the stuff that I talked about in that episode about the populares and the optimates, the two factions within Roman politics toward the end of the Republic, and what the Roman Republic, the government of the Roman Republic was like, and all that. So this is our Christmas episode, and I just wanted to say as well that Merry Christmas to everyone, Happy Yule. I try to do a Christmas episode free for the people every year because Christmas to me is a political holiday. Like anything important, Christmas concerns community. And I've spent a lot of Christmases just by myself, or not by myself, but with friends, with not with family, but just with friends talking about the Jews. And this is a great way to spend Christmas. And I know there's a lot of people out there who maybe don't have family, don't have friends to spend time with. So that's why we do a Christmas episode where we talk about important questions. I guess we won't necessarily be talking about the Jews today, but I'm sure they'll come up. And talking about Jews is, you know, it is the question of American politics, worldwide politics today. So it's naturally something that, you know, comes up and that I think has a place on Christmas when you're thinking about your community and the future of your race. So, Roman, welcome, and how are you doing, and can you outline your article a little bit for us?
Yeah, good Yule, och et gott nytt år, också. So, yeah, I wrote the article. I'm already regretting some of it, because for this episode, I went back over the Caesarian history, and Trump, in the article, I make the comparison, of course, with Trump to Caesar. Also a little bit Elon Musk in that he has a little bit of that flavor. And they're kind of almost like, you know, you could see them as two of the characters like Pompey and Caesar, or Crassus and Caesar. But I make the point that it's all fucked up, and that he's like a fake Caesar. Perhaps even intentionally, I don't know how conscious, you know, when
maybe the masters of the world right now have read the Roman history and they're like, all right, we need to have a fake Caesar to direct this energy into something controlled.
Exactly. Or they just have a sense, like I think in the article I even referenced that I couldn't find where the quote was, but I know this is this was said when Jared Kushner first went to one of the Trump rallies in the first campaign, and he saw all the angry white people saying like fuck the media and such things, and if he was afraid.
Yeah, right, you mentioned that.
And then he must have, you know, him and the kind of Lubavitcher or whatever you want to call the Jignat wing made a decision that they were going to back Trump and try to divert the energy, which is what they're kind of always doing in one way or another. Since writing that article, I've even changed my perspective a little bit, because I was thinking about pseudomorphosis of culture, and I'm not sure Trump is a fake Caesar. I think that our culture is, or our civilization is, under this late quasi pseudomorphosis, and that he's actually the right a Caesar for our civilization is
our civilization is so fake and gay that we have a fake and gay Caesar.
Right. He fits like this. So it's, you know, Western civilization as pseudomorphosized by Judaism or, you know, the Magian Jewish remnant culture, civilization, or whatever you want to call it, changing what would have been a more natural Caesar that would behave in ways that people like us wouldn't constantly be like, he's not, you know, he's not your guy, you know, trying to say it to Trump supporters.
All right. So, yeah, you're referencing the Spengler theory, Oswald Spengler's notion that you have these different civilizations, like you have the ancient Roman civilization, or we'd say the classical civilization, and like the Middle Eastern civilization of that time period. And you can have pseudomorphosis, which is where a older, more established civilization's culture and mores sort of rub off on the other newer civilization, and that civilization sort of adopts some of the ideas and outward forms of the older civilization. I think a good example of that that everyone knows would be like Russia under Peter the Great, in the next two centuries, really aping European culture, even though Russia is very different from Europe. And then to make this like relevant to what you're talking about with Jews in the West being that alien culture who are influencing the development of Western civilization. Well, in Caesar's time, that would have been, you know, Rome and Greece. The classical civilization was the older civilization, and it was having an effect on this newly arising civilization in the Middle East, which Spengler calls the Magian civilization. And that would be roughly from the time of Jesus to like 1000 AD or to Al-Farabi. Al-Ghazali. So it's the Middle East, including Islam being the centerpiece of that Middle Eastern development and preceded by a lot of the Aramaic and Syriac culture and a lot of the religions of like the Magians or the Manichees, Manichees or the followers of Zarathustra, all that, and the ancient Jews, all that stuff. So, sorry, just giving the background for anybody who isn't a Spengler fag like you or me.
Right. And then I would add that, unless I'm mistaken, I think our pseudomorphosis is unique in that usually they happen to a pre-culture or an early culture that's growing up basically in the shadow of an established culture.
So like the ancient Germans being influenced by the Romans or something would be correct. That. But,
exactly.
But in this case, we have this Jewish remnant culture of that Magian culture I just referenced, this little piece of this frozen thing that's lasted for 1,000 years and hasn't had any cultural development since then. And now it, in the form of the Jews, controls Western civilization as sort of a parasite.
Yeah, it's infection is definitely it makes me think of, you know, those kind of sci-fi ideas of like digging into the Arctic, the ice, what are they called? The ice cores.
Ice cores.
Ancient bacteria, you know, he pulls out and it's, you know, it's been frozen for 10 million years or something. And it just is super infectious, something like that. Or a virus. I think viral theory is that, you know, say for human viruses, our DNA breaks off some piece. And this happens all the time. You know, cells fall apart and the DNA gets chopped up. And there's just some bit that has enough instructions to trick one of our cells to let it in, like self-recognition, and to replicate. And that's a virus. But whatever analogy you want to use. Yes, because it's not really the greater Magian or Arabian civilization itself that is influencing us or that influenced us early. You know, like, for example, if European knights had been using like scimitars and calling themselves caliph. Yeah. Calling themselves caliph instead of emperor, you know, then that's what that would have been, is like a kind of more natural pseudomorphosis of the early culture. But this is like, yes, something from a long time ago showing up and hijacking an established civilization that's kind of maybe in the midway of its civilization phase, so fairly late in the game.
Let's get back to this idea of pseudomorphosis and and the Jews. I know everybody wants to talk about the Jews, but let's get back into Caesar and sort of build back up to this, because Caesar himself, there's a lot of, some people will theorize that Caesar was, I mean, he was truly a great man and a very unusual man. And there is a bit of an argument about whether Caesar understood his place in history, whether he, maybe he saw that the Roman Republic needed to be torn down. And that's why he acted the way he did, especially later in life during, after, you know, during the conquest of Gaul, or especially during the civil wars from 49 to 44 BC. The other thesis is that he simply was acting in his own self-interest the entire time. And when he crossed the Rubicon and invaded Italy, you know, literally crossed the Rubicon River, not crossed the Rubicon as people use that as a cliche, but he crossed the actual Rubicon and invaded Italy with one legion in contravention or against the law of the Roman state, that what he was doing was, he knew it to be an illegal act, and he just didn't care because he didn't like have any sort of greater moral or historical justification for his actions. It was purely self-interested. And I'm not sure I believe that. I'm skeptical of the notion that a man who has led people in battle at great risk to himself, not quite as much as Alexander, for instance, but Caesar definitely did lead from the front in a lot of situations. I find it hard to believe that someone like that could be a pure individualist cynic. To my mind, usually great men have some kind of combination of bravery tends to go along with truth orientation and idealism. It doesn't tend to go along with being selfish, but I don't know. Different historians have different ideas. But let's talk about the background on the Roman government at the time. You mentioned the article, the Populares and the Optimates, and the growing civil war, or the growing political friction between the two of them.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the best compares. So people are always comparing, maybe not always, but it's been pretty popular to say, oh, you know, America is like Rome, you know, decadent. And then they've got a bunch of like people throw out little factoids like, celebrity chefs became popular, you know, in the end of the Republic. And
yeah, Cato the Elder complains a lot about that. Like the slave should be the lowest, the chef should be the lowest slave in your household if you're a proper Roman, you know. But these decadent Greeks coming in here want to hire Greek chefs and stuff. Ugh, God.
Right. But I think just to kind of scrub away all of that more surface level stuff, the basic issue in Caesarism, so both Caesar, the actual Roman historical period, and Spengler claims, and I agree, that this happens in every culture civilization that is that progresses to the civilization phase. It has a time when it has a certain form of government. So in the case of classical, it was the Roman Republic. And then as an analogy, so for us, our culture occurred in Europe, in Western Europe. And I would say because of World War II, the civilization, it kind of started in Europe and then is really more being completed in America. And then in the case of classical, the culture was Greece and the civilization was completed in Rome. Kind of in a similar way that Rome militarily... Right. defeated Greece and subjugated it, as America has done.
I completely agree with Europe is to Greece what America is to Rome. Completely valid Spenglerian analogy. And when you're saying culture versus civilization, for those who haven't listened to our previous episodes on Spengler or haven't read Spengler, the distinction is basically culture is the 1,000 years from the birth of your culture until your artistic and religious and philosophical ideas have exhausted themselves. And in the West, that seems to have happened sometime around 1830, at the very latest 1900. people were noticing in the early 20th century, certainly Spengler being one of them, but many others went along with this too and had the same opinion that it was clear that art was done. There was nothing interesting being said. Philosophy was going off to increasingly arcane and technical discussions that had no relevance or no possible, they weren't at all fruitful to any further great cultural ideas or great philosophical systems. And that now we're in the civilization phase of our development. So that means, just like the Romans, now America or America, Europe, since philosophy and art are over with, now we have to go into the only realms of development that will be interesting will be technics, lawyering, politics, and you know, architecture, building big things, applying all of the ideas of the art and the philosophy of the old culture and making it bigger and bigger and more grandiose and gigantic.
Yeah, but, and sorry, this is why I identify Trump and Musk, because Trump builds big buildings and Musk, of course, is trying to take us into space, which I would really think it would be the culmination of our techniques.
Yeah, these are the sort of absurd ends of Western techniques, should be big, awesome American buildings and going into space. So yeah, Trump and Musk are very good representatives of that.
So during this time period, it's like there's this, a structure of government. So whether it's the Roman Republic or the American Republic system, and there's the literal rules, like the laws of how the government is structured and the norms. And then there's kind of an unspoken deal. So in the case of Rome, there was a deal for a long time since Rome became a republic where the army was made up of the yeoman farmers and the elite, and they would go on campaign for the good of Rome, and perhaps not completely proportionally, but everybody would kind of benefit, whether it was a defensive, you know, in a case of a defensive war, everybody kind of benefits because the state doesn't fall, or a more offensive war, which Rome always, much like America, Rome tried to justify all of its offensive wars as defensive, like forward defense.
right.
Preemptive strikes, very similar.
We're going to take out those Sabines, otherwise they'll come and destroy our republic.
Yeah, or we have to take over more of Gaul so that the Germans can't get to us without going through more defensive, you know, realm or something. So there's a certain deal. In America, I guess it's maybe a little bit harder to articulate, but you could kind of call it, you know, the what has been called the American dream or the middle class, you know.
Yeah, the American social contract. Yeah, the American dream, right? You fight your war for Zog, you get to go to college on the government's dime, and then you get issued a fairly hot wife and a house.
Right. Yeah, and a job where, you know, it's not super competitive.
But not backbreaking. Yeah, right.
So in the case of Rome, this contract was breaking down. So when the army is made up of these yeoman farmers, that's fine when the campaigns are right on the borders of Rome. But when they're in Gaul or Spain or North Africa or whatever, far into the east, and these people, these men, are asked to leave their farms fallow for over a year, and there's no compensation for that other than what they perhaps loot. What ended up happening is the people that already had a lot of property or a lot of saved up, you know, gold or specie, were able to start buying up these farms because the men that went away too long on campaign for their country could lose their farms because they would be in debt. They would come back and they hadn't made any income from their farm for 1 year or more. And then so they would sell their farm. So the elite that ironically tended to not go away on campaign, or if they did, it would just be as the general, you know, like a proconsul or something.
They certainly had people who could manage their farms,
exactly,
and estates back in Italy. So it wasn't a thing for them to go campaign in, you know, Syria for 3 years or 5 years.
Kind of like the regulatory state in America, the big business likes it because they can afford to have, you know, lawyers on staff to go through with those, but small businesses keep getting squeezed out more and more. So you had this breakdown of the system, and it just wasn't physically possible, and there had to be some type of reform, and people kept bringing up like land reforms, you know, that veterans, they started to opening up the ranks to people who didn't own property. That was one of the first things, which we can kind of see American military has been relaxing quite a bit. I mean, we've gotten all the way to the part of bringing the Gauls in and other peoples into the military. You know, America imports like Guatemalans.
So first it was with the land reform thing that was under the brothers Gracchus, Tiberius and Gaius. That was like the 130s BC. That was like the thing in Roman politics. The Gracchus brothers were both aristocrats and they were trying to do reform from the inside. They saw the problem in the system. They rallied a big movement around themselves to get land reform, to deal with this problem with the military, the soldiers being kicked off their farms and land distribution not working right and people being pushed into the city of Rome. They tried to do that whole reform. The senatorial aristocracy was not having it. And it's not because they didn't recognize the problem. It's because the aristocrats, I mean, this is my reading of it, is the aristocrats all, if anybody tried to do something about the problem, that guy was therefore a threat to the system because he would get super popular. So the aristocrats just reactively opposed the Gracchus brothers' reforms, and both of them got killed. Both of those brothers got killed. And so the problem festered. And then you mentioned they professionalized the military. Well, that was Marius and he was a big politician. He came to power in the like 100s BC, right around the turn of the century there. He was campaigning, he was fighting wars in what's now Algeria and Numidia. And he then became the savior of Rome when he helped to organize the military to throw out an invasion by two major Germanic tribes that had descended upon provincial Gaul and northern Italy, the Cimbri and the Teutons. And he Marius annihilated them, and he professionalized the army. So he, up to that point, like you were saying, it was yeoman farmers. It was much more of a traditional sort of militia system. But then after that, it was a 20 or 25 year contract, and you serve with your general, you were issued all your equipment, you were expected to carry all of your shit, no more baggage trains. But they started opening the ranks, especially after Marius, they started to open the ranks more to foreigners. And initially, like you were saying with Gaul, it was more like auxiliaries, but then like auxiliary cavalry, the Romans sucked at cavalry, so they liked to hire Gauls and Germans for that. But increasingly it became, as far as I know with the Romans, more this became a thing in like the first and second centuries AD, was in recruiting provincials, Spaniards and Gauls and whatever else into the legions themselves. And the Italians, the companion like peasantry, really only was out of the Roman military and no longer in it by like the second century or third century AD.
Yeah, so I think the timeline is a little different for us, because in America, we're kind of already there. There was that attempt to kind of purge, especially right wing, but kind of like white men.
Your American military is Appalachians, Southerners, Appalachians, Texans, if you want to include that as a separate category, and Midwesterners.
Right. And I think the system understands that, and they're going to go back and at least try to keep a fighting force of those traditional groups, and maybe give all the like desk jockey jobs to black women.
Blacks and Mexicans.
Yeah. And people that they definitely want a military force that they can turn on the American people. Forget that. White guys would do that anyway, probably. depending on what the situation was. I mean, the military, it's disappointing. I mean, the police, obviously, the police force is obviously not squeamish about enforcing against the people. So, yeah, so in our system, the analogy to the breakdown in the Roman social contract would be, you know, yeah, the shrinking of the middle class, and also the very clear, obvious in your face, so obvious that it's that nobody even talks about it. Lack of accountability of Congress and the federal government. There's everybody understands. Yeah, it's like they understand it so well that nobody even talks about it. And they end up talking about other things, that the what becomes policy has nothing to do with the American will whatsoever. And then it's called democratic. Not only, it's called more democratic than, you know, 100 years ago when it was more closely democratic. Related.
You could go and make $1 billion and go buy your own politicians. That's how democratic it is.
Exactly. And that's the form. So that's the form that it's taking here. And in Rome, the form that it took was the Senate itself was there were all these different ways that by staffing certain positions, you know, aedileships or tribunates, that they could block land reforms. And then even when necessary, so even the most, you know, Cato the Younger, even the most supposedly consistent Republicans would engage in mob tactics, or if not engage in, cheer them on when it was against people they didn't like. So there's always a way, you know, when there's a power elite, there's always a way to block the will of the people. And yeah, and just like what you said, that anybody who appealed to the people would be seen as a threat. That was the system in the 2016 Trump. You know, it's like you're not allowed to actually get up on stage. There was this unspoken rule that seems so strange to people that are kind of outside of the mainstream brainwashing, that you can't actually propose things that the people want, because that's populism, which is somehow bad. Like, democracy is good, but populism is bad.
I wrote an article back in 2016. Maybe I can find it. I'm sure I have it saved somewhere. It was a pretty long one, where I compared Trump to Tiberius Gracchus. And I said that he is America's Tiberius Gracchus. And I'm sticking by that that Spenglerian analogy. I don't think he's Caesar. I don't think he's even a fake, like, Jewish pseudomorphosis Caesar. I think he's Gracchus. But
I was actually going with Clodius.
Okay, well, Clodius Pulcher.
Yeah, Pulcher, yeah.
Do you want to explain who that is?
He was during roughly the time of Caesar, a post-Gracchi, sort of a wild man, a kind of like a, almost like a Hunter Biden type, like a degenerate elite.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah.
And he was from, so there was this funny thing in the Republic where you had guys like Cicero who did not come from an elite background, and because of that, felt insecure, and they felt like they needed to suck up.
Fucking J.V. Vance. Yeah, Cicero is J.V. Vance, except more eloquent.
Yeah, Cicero is kind of like the good side of Cicero would be like Ron Paul.
Okay, that's fair. I'm being uncharitable. Yeah, I agree.
Well, the bad side of Cicero, because he's not Ron Paul. Ron Paul is much better than Cicero, which is why Ron Paul was kept away from power ultimately. But yeah, the bad side of Cicero would be like a J.D. Vance, or it's just somebody that kind of works up the social credit of being a straight shooter and then uses it for personal gain, or when the things get too hot, you know, sells out.
Being a big shill for the system like Cicero.
Right. And so somebody like Cicero, kind of like, in a way, this is almost like Trump, because there is an insecurity with Trump, that his family is a little bit looked down upon because they have this kind of seedy, like, Jewish New York real estate wealth, rather than, you know, I don't know, if he was like the heir of Carnegie Steel or something. So Clodius was the heir of like one of the most respected, the oldest Roman families. So because of this, this often happens. The most elite of the elite don't have the insecurity that they need to signal. Like, for example, an upper middle class person would be afraid to decorate their house with anything that a lower class person would have, because somebody might confuse them for a lower class person or a lower middle class person or what the fuck ever. But if you are a super wealthy person,
when you're at that Hunter Biden or Clodius Pulcher level, you have no problem going out there and being a total fucking clown.
Right, because you can always refer to your name. You can always regain the doors don't close to you, or it's very difficult for the doors to close to you. Whereas somebody like Cicero, if he makes a big misstep or alienates certain people, it's like his invitation to the party is more conditional. Whereas somebody like Clodius has like sort of this permanent stamp, you know, at least for his generation, right? Like they could eventually fuck it up.
Give me the dirty details though. Like Clodius Pulcher is probably the most hilarious guy in all of Roman history.
he's like Trump.
And one quick linguistic note, like Claudius is the real Latin, like aristocratic way to say that name. Claudius. He actually changed his name. He changed the AU in Claudius to Clodius because that was a more proletarian street way to say the name.
Yes. So the analogy with him that I like the best is Trump. You know, Trump is obviously super wealthy, and he kind of not exactly from a storied elite family, but, you know, his father was wealthy and he is an elite. But he speaks on stage, especially you can watch a 30-year-old video of him and he sounds much more intelligent. He dumbed down the way he talks. The thing where he's at McDonald's, you know, so Clodius literally legally changed. So there was patricians, right, which are people from families that have these names. And then everybody else is a plebeian. So there are certain positions in the state that for the tribunate specifically cannot be held by a patrician. You have to be a plebeian. So Clodius wanted to have that position. So he had a plebeian family. Well, he was like 30 in his 30s or something. And he got adopted into a plebeian family and gave up his patrician status. Somebody like him who is such a patrician's patrician can do that in a way that maybe somebody on the lower end of the patrician class structure would feel self-conscious doing. So it makes me think of Trump and McDonald's and Trump in that garbage truck, how he talks with his hands and he repeats things, tries to sound
Trump
less intelligent.
Trump does do a lot of that lower class signaling. Like he wants to establish that he's got the class credentials of I'm super rich and a buffoon. I wear a big tie and a suit and everything and I'm rich, so big, so much. But then at the same time, I'll drive a garbage truck and work at McDonald's. Like it's a very similar thing. The other one I was just thinking of when you were talking about the way he talks, George W. Bush, that guy did not talk as president the way he learned to talk at Yale.
Right. Do you think that was George W. Bush actually seems legitimately dumb enough, or maybe he fried his brain with drugs?
It was all a front. If you look at his older videos, he talks very differently.
Oh, and you don't think it was drugs? Because he was a drug addict for a while.
He was playing a character. Maybe it was drugs. I don't know. I think he was playing a character, though. He's like, yeah, I'm from Texas, down home, and strategery. And like, he was mocking the American people. It's really disgusting, actually, is what it is. A fucking Jewish puppet. Right. But, yeah.
So Clodius would specifically, and perhaps the most Trumpian thing that he did is he used these gutter tactics. So he was known, he was a degenerate partier. So he would go around to parties and dance, which was a scandalous thing to be a good dancer in Rome. It was like considered feminine.
Right.
And kind of, you know, low key gay. And perhaps Clodius was even low key, you know, gay or bi or whatever, dressed like women sometimes and dancing. And then he would actually stand up in front of the forum or the Senate and insult other men as dancers. And it's just so Trumpian because Trump will just say anything. It doesn't matter whether it's consistent intellectually, whether it's hypocritical, whether he fits the insult he's throwing out more than the target. He just says it. And he says it with such I mean, these days we could say chutzpah, but back in Clodius's time, you know, it was pre that term, Yiddish. But it's like if you have a certain amount of wealth and a certain amount of charisma and you just say things confidently, a percentage of the populace will just go along with it. You know, you just have to sell it. So that was right. Clodius.
When you're a Clodius or a Trump, you can get away with it too, or it's actually to your advantage to be a total clown, because then it's impossible for people to make fun of you. Whereas someone like Cicero, standing on ceremony, standing on this pretense of dignity, he's vulnerable to being lampooned by a Clodius or a Trump because he has this, he has to maintain this appearance of dignity.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Because Cicero is kind of trapped in between Clodius on one side and like Cato on the other. So Cato went as full as you could go sincerity. So it's kind of harder to make fun of Cato because Cato would actually just like rip his guts open rather than, you know, feel embarrassed about something. And then on the other hand, Clodius, it has ironic armor. And then Cicero is in the middle where he wants to be taken seriously, but he feels embarrassed and he is crumbles under social pressure. So if there is enough social pressure, so you can imagine these, you know, fair weather friend politicians like Matt Gaetz or something, he'll say all this good shit. But if the winds were to change, I mean, we know that somebody like that would not. I mean, he's out of government now, but there's no way he would stand up to danger to his person or to his, you know, lifestyle or whatever, if everything all of a sudden flipped in terms of what kind of things you had to say to get or maintain power or a power block. Whereas somebody like Cato is a true believer, is harder to make fun of. You can do it, and he did have some hypocritical things, like he turned a blind eye to when. So Clodius, one of the things that he did was he kind of had like an Antifa type situation, mob violence in Rome, and almost similar to like a January 6th type thing, where it used to be the idea of using violence in the city for political purposes was just. It wasn't even so much that there was a written rule against it. It was just unthinkable. And when something's unthinkable and then somebody just thinks to do it, it can be very effective because nobody's expecting it. And there's no, you know, you end up being that guy that's like, you can't do that. And then people just like hit you, you know, assault you. And he chased Cicero out.
One of these just like gang leaders.
Yeah. So he chased Cicero out of Rome for several years, right? After Cicero had been, what was his last position? Consulate?
He was consul in 63.
Yeah. So after that, after he was one of the highest positions in government, he was chased out of Rome, sent into exile, after having been celebrated as saving the Republic. I guess we're kind of jumping around a little bit too much in this history, but after the Gracchi failed and were killed in their populares, there were other people, the Catiline and people that are kind of all sort of related to these main characters like Pompey and Caesar. So Marius versus Sulla would be the big one. Marius was
that was the 100s, 90s, 80s BC. Sulla, I think Sulla took Rome in 88 BC. Marius died that year as well. And Marius was the popular politician, whereas Sulla was the aristocratic optimate politician.
Which is funny because Sulla didn't come from a family like that. Like, wasn't he like a, I don't know, was he a prostitute or he lived with prostitutes when he was younger?
He was not a prostitute. But no, you're
those were his friends though, right?
He was a Chad bro. My reading of Sulla is that he was like upper middle class, but like fallen upper middle class who would LARP as an aristocrat, but also would hang out with actors and prostitutes and drink a lot. Yes. He was like a mix of everything. Like he didn't give a shit. He was willing to be as much of a, maybe not as much of a clown as Clodius Pulcher, but he wasn't in that. Yeah, you're right. He wasn't that aristocratic, but he had a lot of the appearance of being aristocratic, and he was also willing to dispense with that.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, these defenders of the Republic, like Sulla, you know, will simply become dictator, which is anti-Republican. So there's a certain, and the Americans would be very familiar with this, a certain hypocrisy to all sides, right? They say, oh, this guy's, he's breaking the rules, so we better stop him.
Sulla broke the rules to make people stop breaking the rules. Right. He broke the rules once and for all to like force through some reforms that he thought would set the Republic back on course.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like George W. Bush and like, oh, we have to regulate capitalism to save capitalism or whatever he said and when the markets crashed.
Oh, that's not fair. I can't compare Sulla to fucking Bush.
No.
I would compare him to, let's say,
It might not have happened yet.
Yeah, it hasn't happened yet. We haven't had our Sulla yet, but I mean, just picking somebody like a rough analogy, right? Maybe like a Napoleon. No, not Napoleon. He wasn't like if George Washington like proclaimed himself dictator. Yeah, it's hard to come up with something that's a real match for Sulla, but he really did try to reestablish the Republic by, well, marching on Rome and violating all the rules, because there really wasn't any other way to do it, being dictator and purging a lot of people.
All right, you might not like this one, but I'm going to go with Abraham Lincoln.
The ends might not have been as
good, but, you know, sort of, we can't let, I mean, it's clearly constitutional. Or at least when the Constitution was created, the right to secede was there. and it was, you know, literally there. And there were discussions about this, and it's very, very clear. And however, he saw the Union kind of like idealized the way that the Optimates idealized the Roman Republican system, and he broke the rules of the Union to save the Union. Sort of, you know, in a rough. Yeah,
no, that's fair. I mean, it's not as we acknowledge that that's not a strict Spenglerian analogy, but just to illustrate the point of who Sulla was.
So you had the Gracchi, Sulla versus Marius. And then a couple of smaller characters. So the Catiline conspiracy, which was kind of like a pretty shitty attempt at a coup.
It was very much based on like opposing usury and opposing debt. There's some articles on Influence Review by what's his name? That communist, or he's LARPs as a communist, Michael. Shit. I'll find it, but there's some people say that Catiline was very much a financial conflict, and Catiline represented the popular desire to get rid of all of these abusive debts. Is that your impression of him?
Ending debts was a big part of his program. I guess he didn't focus on the land reform question as much. I guess the debt issue is what made him an enemy to, you know, somebody like Crassus. But
Michael Hudson, that's the guy I was thinking of on Unst Review. Michael Hudson, he's he's a Marxist, I guess. I don't really believe that based on his writing. He's like kind of shitty because he does Marxist theories, but he also has some stuff that is like, I will qualifiedly say is like kind of good historical analysis, but whatever. Yeah. Anyway, Catiline.
Yeah. So he was gathering power players to try to have a bit of a coup against the senatorial system that people kept trying to get at it from different angles. And it happened under Cicero's consul. And basically somebody leaked the information about it. And unconstitutionally, Cicero essentially brought all of the conspirators minus one or two that he didn't want, that he would be afraid of naming, you know, so there was perhaps some evidence that Caesar was a co-conspirator, or at least knew about it and didn't say anything, but he didn't want to make Caesar an enemy, and he knew that Caesar could get away and fight back. But basically all the people that were politically possible to execute, he kind of just arrested them, put them in a cave, and like strangled all of them to death, or at least had, you know, heavies do that, and was hailed as the savior of the Republic. And then just a few years later, Clodius whipped up a mob and said, you know, the murder of Cat, tried to prosecute in the law courts Cicero for the murder of Catiline, and got him to self-exile, and then had the mob rip down his house like brick by brick. And so it was just not there anymore.
Based.
Yeah. So these things are happening. And then Caesar represents kind of the final, well, Caesar and then the Caesars that follow, there, you know, Octavian, etc., that finish the revolution, represents the last act of this, these mini civil wars, or full blown civil wars, with some interceding mini political events like the Catiline conspiracy, between in this impossible situation, which is the Republic can't keep expanding. Rome can't, you know, take more of Gaul and eventually go into Britain and go east and go into Africa in the system of, in the Republican system and the military system that it has, and the land system, they kept putting band-aids on the situation, which is also something Americans are very familiar with, rather than dealing with any of these problems.
There's no long-sighted policy whatsoever in the Republic, you know, especially
it's like
between
increase the grain. What's it called? At first it was just, I think, like a subsidized price, and then it became just straight up free grain for people in the city, and just things like that, you know, to keep them from, you know, rioting and having a revolution. And when Caesar,
I was going to interject. Speaking of Pulcher, Clodius Pulcher, do you know who his main enemy was in the street, the fighting, the gang raising?
Yeah, it was somebody that was brought on by. Was it Cato's guy?
It's a name that should be familiar to everybody. It was Milo.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was the brought in to bring his own mob of gladiators.
Yeah.
He wasn't Greek, was he?
I don't know. I don't know if he was Greek, but he was probably gay.
Milo something Polis.
Pulcher was into dressing like a woman, as you said, and he got into trouble for it in a number of occasions.
Yeah. One time he snuck into the Good Goddess rites festival at Caesar's house, where his mom and his wife were, to supposedly sleep with Caesar's wife, and very, very weird. But again, kind of scandal that would not seem that strange to modern Americans, actually, that one politician would be sleeping secretly or trying to sleep with another one's wife.
Well, it's not even that. He dressing as a woman to do so. Like, right. Hey, baby, I sneaked in here for some action. How do you play that? I don't even, like, I'm not that, I guess I'm not that much of a Hunter Biden to, like, imagine how you would do that.
Yeah, he reminds me of that. Putting
on a wig and sneaking to a woman's house and being like, yo.
Well, it's like he's so straight that he'll cross-dress and act like a woman for pussy. Yeah. Like, it reminds me of, like, the 2000s, like, the aughts bro movies, you know, where it's like, I'm so straight.
wow, yeah.
So when you were talking about Caesar and whether he was had these. So this is kind of the background. These are some of the characters. Whether he had this political superstructure in mind when he crossed the Rubicon or self-interest. The thing was, his self-interest, it wasn't just to take Rome. He was being personally. So he was in a situation actually quite like Trump in that what was happening was Cato and the sort of Optimates forces, the forces that were bitter against, he had broken a lot of laws in his governorship of Gaul in order to essentially invade more territory. And an act that the people of Rome liked. So nobody had a problem with it except the by the book people like Cato and the people, the other power players that were afraid of the wealth and power and prestige that he was gaining doing these acts that were performed illegally. So what was, once his proconsulship ends, he has to return to the city as a private citizen before he can run for some other office. So during that time period, he is prosecutable. And Cato and allies had made no secret that they were going to try to prosecute him and essentially get him the Cicero treatment, you know, exile. So his choice was take a chance at having his entire career destroyed, perhaps even killed, but generally Roman elites were allowed to exile themselves when they would be found guilty of whatever it was that would be a killing offense. And or just break one more, but like the ultimate, you know, break the ultimate taboo and cross into Roman territory without disbanding your army. So there was a culture that there would be no. That's why mob violence was so successful in the time of Clodius and after, was because there wasn't really military presence in Rome. There wasn't really a police presence. It was just kind of like a gentleman's agreement that violence, especially political violence, just didn't take place. You weren't really allowed to. Yeah, it just wasn't a thing. And
it's
so
the same thing that we have today, where it's like violence isn't allowed, but any amount of machination and double dealing and sneaky treachery Jewish bullshit is allowed. And you know, this when this goes on for generations or decades, and violence isn't allowed but treachery is, then you start getting things like Caesar crossing the Rubicon, or another example of this phenomenon is the Luigi assassination.
Yes.
When people feel they have no recourse and no ability to bring about, you know, justice through the system, then they're just going to, you know, escalate in out of desperation.
Yeah, exactly. That's something that I meant to include in the breakdown of the deal, is that there was an unspoken social contract that, yes, of course, we don't use violence, we follow the Republican rules, but the normal people don't get fucked over by the elites who keep getting richer and richer. And it's the same problem that we're having in America, where, you know, there's this cultural schizophrenia similar to what we have, where conservatives are always discovering new ways where they somehow end up, you know, the rich somehow just end up keep getting richer and richer. And they're not maybe technically breaking the rules because they keep legally discovering new ways to get around, like, things that were supposed to stop that, or even new values. Like, you know, American conservatives have discovered the new conservative values of gay marriage, multiculturalism, world empire,
grannyism.
Yeah, as long as the trannies are better looking than the other side's trannies, than their conservative trannies.
Yeah, I guess that's the deal, right?
So they pretend to respect the Constitution, and in a certain kind of Talmudic almost way, they do respect the letters of the law, but it's in the sense of like what it means and what it's supposed to, the policy, it's the way things are supposed to go. It's like a dead letter. It doesn't restrain the elite. Congress, you know, is a whorehouse, a glorified whorehouse. I mean, weren't those the two guys who were like fucking in the senatorial chambers last year?
Yeah, that was the thing. There's that film of these faggots just fucking in the Senate, and everyone's like, oh yeah, okay, I guess we'll give them a slap on the wrist. Meanwhile, if you say Hitler was okay at some point in your life and someone tells on you, then you lose your job, but you're allowed to like, yeah, commit sodomy in the Senate House, and everyone's just like, oh yeah, this is you know, freedom and democracy at work here.
Right. So in the same kind of way where there's just this vibe where it's considered against the rules for somebody like Trump to bring issues directly to the people. So you have to bring it to the Senate, you know, and then you have to bring it to the mainstream institutions that will censor what the people want so that it never gets brought up. Actually, Caesar did something just like that. Was Cato Aedile, when he was blocking, he was kind of filibustering Caesar, and Caesar, I think he had like dung poured on him, but then Cato didn't stop, or he got arrested, and then everybody was kind of on Cato's side because he kept his honor and just went off to jail. So then what Caesar did is let him out of jail and then just went to the forum and started bringing the ideas directly to the people and not through the Senate when he was consul, kind of like Trump, you know, talking directly to the people, or at least pretending to. And yeah, there's the elites will actually tell you it's undemocratic to do that. Like in America, they'll kind of get on TV and be like, oh, this is a danger to our democracy. It's like a man actually saying to the crowd, like acknowledging or saying things that they feel, but no other elites are, there's no representation for representing the democratic will. You know, they'll try to come up with a way. So that same type of thing was happening in Rome at the time. And Caesar ended up being the figurehead of it. He had a family history of it. You know, Marius was his, was it uncle-in-law?
I forget. There was some merit distant relationship there.
Yeah. So he was considered, he wasn't put, on the original when Sulla defeated Marius and took over, there was these, prescription lists of people that were, it's okay to kill.
A quick note on Sulla. We put him in the Optimate camp, but I think, you know, a lot of the people that Sulla was prescribing, that is to say, putting their name on a list that authorized any citizen to go out and kill them and take their shit, a lot of them were just real estate speculators. And so it's kind of funny how the Optimate Populare distinction in Roman politics shouldn't be thought of as like strictly Republican Democrat or conservative liberal. The Optimates had elements of the military and the upper, I guess most of the real old money aristocrats, and then the Populares had some of the like the knights, the equites, but there were like, there were all kinds of crossings like that. So anyway, that's,
I think that does make it a good analogy, though.
I have a soft spot for Sulla because a lot of the people that he was killing fucking just had it coming.
Yeah, but don't you think that's like our situation with Democrats and Republicans, or whatever you want to, however you want to slice it up? Because it's not really that the Republicans, you know, a Democrat, like a white, you know, like a white swipple Democrat would say, oh, the Republicans are the parties of the rich people. But I mean, there's tons of rich people and elites. I mean, the elites, like the cultural elites, you know, Hollywood actors and the people on the TV that tell you what to think, they're all Democrats for the most part. And then, you know, if you say, oh, you know, the Democrats are the party of I don't know, the working class or something. But it's like it's not, you know, they're kind of the party of like the inner, the city, Democrat machine, union, like union and public service working class, but
all,
not.
All I was saying with Sulla is just that you can't, if the optimates were the Republicans or the conservatives, you can't imagine a conservative marching on Washington and posting up prescription lists, including, you know, real estate speculators on it. At least not now. I can't. Maybe in 20 years I could see that.
Well, if Trump wasn't a real estate speculator, I could see Trump doing that. Like, I could see somebody like Trump putting a prescription list that includes, you know,
Larry elite. Fink.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, like, people that do too much business with China or something like that, right? Like,
oh yeah, something kind of gay like that I could see, but yeah, not getting to the heart of the matter.
But I do think that the schizophrenia of the party system is similar to America, because it really, there are, to quote Trump, there's good people on both sides. Not in the sense like, there are literally good people on both sides, but more so there are all types of people. Like, there are black people, you know, traditionally, I guess they would vote Democrat, especially in the cities, but more and more, especially with this MAGA thing. I mean, the party system flips in America every so often. And I think we're in the middle of a flip right now from Trumpism.
What's funny too about the party system is that in Rome, I was reading this book by this, German professor named Christian Meyer. He's like one of the main biographers of Caesar. And I just like kind of flipped through the first few chapters and got his overall argument. And what he argues is that nobody in Rome at the time of Caesar really opposed the system, or like there was no faction calling for the overthrow of the Republic. And that, you know, with the Gracchi brothers, for instance, there was no, after the two of them were assassinated, there was no Gracchi faction that stayed on. It just sort of dissipated. And what's funny about this Christian Meyer guy, as he's talking about how in Rome there was nobody that could imagine an alternate system, he's sort of implying that there is in America and in Europe today. This was written in 1995, so fairly recently. And he's, I guess, implying maybe communists or something. And then, you know, typical of a German author, he has to mention Hitler as being just like, oh, it's just this aberration. We just can't understand like where this guy comes from. But it struck me as like, it's like obvious. Hitler in our world is the alternative to this fake and gay system that we have, where nobody can imagine an alternative to Jewish democracy. And likewise in Rome, there was some idea out there of, well, we could have a different system. And there's, you know, obviously, I guess, no evidence of that. There's no historical record saying that, well, there was this opposition party or system or something. Actually, the way that Meyer talks about it is, he says there was, the society was united, but the realities were separate. And that's a little bit of flowery academic language. What he means is, people understood reality in two different ways. On one hand, you had most of all society, which only saw the legalistic outward forms and saw Republic and Senate and the rules as they were. And then you had a realist like Caesar, who was able to see through all of the bullshit. And Meyer is suggesting that there's nothing like that today. But it's like, you know, I think today Nazis are that. We see through the bullshit and see how things need to go in the future.
Right. I think that we do have a bit of it's like a body without a head problem, in the sense like the system has like infinite shills to just, like, if Luigi Mangione was able to teleport around and just assassinate, like, you know, 10,000 people at key points, there'd just be another 10,000 to staff all of the corporations and the halls of government or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Like, whenever I'm looking around on Twitter, there's just I'll see somebody linked or whatever, and I'll click on this person. It's some journalist with like, it'll be some journalist with 200,000, 500,000 followers who I've never heard of before. And, you know, I follow politics pretty closely, but there's just all these shills. They're everywhere. And you'll like search this person on Google and see like, do they even have a Wikipedia article? Do they have a news article about them? And it's like, no, this person is just a pure Twitter person. And they have this massive following, allegedly. And then they're selling whatever dumbass idea, like, yeah, some liberal woke shit, conservative crap, some blonde girl flying an American flag. God, they trigger me so much. But yeah, no. The shills are everywhere.
Right. So in the case of, yeah, in the case of Rome, like every generation or maybe a couple times every generation, the people, they don't have an expression vector, and then they get one and it kind of boils up and then gets cut down, and then it just falls down because there's like nothing. There's like the people as the base, and then there's this one leader, and there's kind of nothing in between, like a structure. And then finally, Caesar was able to overcome that basically because he just battle hardened a faction of loyal followers and reached the critical mass necessary to overcome the established forces.
He carved out for himself a sort of sphere of influence where he could just do whatever he wanted pretty much without supervision from the rest of the government. So that for him was, you know, Gaul and the Transalpine Gaul. And well, actually, I think he also controlled Cisalpine Gaul. And then later he was assigned Dalmatia. So he had, and then he had all the legions that he had raised and the ones that he'd initially been assigned. So he had a lot of people and a lot of land, revenue streams, slaves. That was totally separate from everything else. Whereas Pompey had been in Rome for the entirety of Caesar's conquest of Gaul throughout the 50s BC. And Pompey hadn't been on campaign in like a decade. And he was very much.
His power base was like effete Eastern kings, like
yeah.
Greece and Parthia and whatnot.
Yeah, right. Effete Eastern kings. And he was friends with all of the big shots in Rome, or a lot of the big shots in Rome, but he didn't really have his own distinct power base. And he had his legions, but it wasn't as he wasn't as like separated from the rest of society as Caesar was.
And he wasn't Caesar's advantage. He didn't keep them trained. And you know, there was a famous jab against Pompey throughout his career, which is that he finished. Lucullus?
Lucullus.
Lucullus, who said that Pompey comes to finish off wars that better men had already won, something like that, because he was always like taking on
Lucullus,
the slave.
Is one to talk. Lucullus is one to talk, being the guy that showed up to finish off Spartacus after Crassus did all the work.
Didn't Pompey also show up and capture some of that glory?
I think it was. It was Pompey. Yeah, it was Pompey and Lucullus.
Yeah. And then Lucullus did most of the heavy lifting, I think, in the East. And then he just sort of lingered too long. He's kind of an interesting character because he seems like he had a period of brilliance as a general. And then he just tried to pacify the entire East, sort of. And then he kind of ran into like an Alexander the Great problem where his people were just wanted to go home, which kind of harkens back to this whole issue with the yeoman farmer force, which is that he's away on campaign and he defeated the enemy whenever they were in the field, and then but he couldn't finish them off because they would just leave.
Respawn.
Yeah, they would the enough of them would get away, and then he's just chasing them all over the Asia.
It's I don't know much about Lucullus, but I remember skimming his biography in Plutarch a while ago, and there's all these stories about him and how, or not about him so much as about the Roman soldiers at that time when Lucullus was campaigning in Asia, and how completely unmotivated they were. Like, it was just comparing the Roman soldier of 80 BC or 70 BC to that the legions of Cannae is just like incomparable. The Romans would take 50,000 casualties in a day in 216 BC, but by 70 BC they couldn't even like keep 80 men in the vacationing on some Greek island without them mutinying.
Right. And to be fair, a lot of that was because they were kept on campaign longer as well.
I'm speaking glibly, but yeah, it was because the Romans were morale were away was so from low home. And righteously low. Like I'm not slighting the legionnaires there. Their low morale was a response to incentives.
Yeah, I think they were also Lucullus was a little strange with the change in terms of the looting rights of the legions, I think, for most of his campaign. Like he was keeping most of it.
That was a practice. He also I guess somewhat famously brought cherry trees back from the east to Italy and planted a lot of those, so I'm sure that wasn't cheap.
And that was part of his, so he had a psychological break later when he was, he was faltering in the east because he won a lot and then he just stayed there and he couldn't finish off the enemy. So then Pompey comes over and does finish off the enemy and kind of unceremonially takes his fasces and takes his control of the legions, which is a very insulting thing for a general to just be replaced like that in Rome. And Lucullus, he spent the rest of his life just like building these ostentatious pleasure gardens, ironically, because he was campaigning against those kinds of people in Greece and looking down his nose at them, you know, as effete Asians. And then he sort of, his way of coping with being overlooked or replaced by Pompey was, but what he said to Pompey, which I think struck a little bit, was that he finished, you know, the war that he kind of mostly won already. And the same with the slave revolt, and the same with, Pompey took out the pirates.
Right.
And none of these were the kind of grinding, consistent, like keeping yourself and your force and your legions in form the way that Gaul was for Caesar. So
and the other one too with Pompey was Spain. Like he got assigned Spain as a province, and then one didn't go there because he wanted to stay in Rome. And not that he was a coward or something. He just, his political fortunes were in Rome, and if he'd gone to Spain, he would have been giving up all of his opportunities in the city. And so he just didn't go to Spain. He assigned it to some other people to lead his legions there, and they just kind of like foundered. I mean, the war in Spain had been going on and off since late 200s BC, so like 150 years at that point, and it didn't end until Augustus. So Pompey couldn't finish that one off,
right?
Just because he didn't, like Lucullus said, he didn't have the staying power and the interest of actually fighting that grinding campaign.
Yeah. Yeah, it actually gets to like one of the lessons that I think is that in action, you know, constantly being tested against a legitimate enemy, not just like some, you know, kind of like in the West, there might come a time when some of the fighting forces of America have a little bit of an embarrassment against, you know, somebody like, I don't know, like Iran or something, because maybe they've been spending their time like killing people in Africa, you know, doing like little things here and there, and basically forces that are not legitimate. And they have, like, America hasn't really been tested against a real army since.
Yeah, that's definitely a phenomenon. America hasn't been tested against a real enemy since 1945 with the Germans and the Japanese. So.
Right.
And at least throughout the 70s and 80s, it was preparing to fight the Russians, or it was prepared to fight them. But in the last 30 or 40 years, it's all been like insurgencies. And so the training and the doctrine and the entire orientation has been, well, this is how we like kill a wedding party of people in Yemen or in whatever near Kandahar. And I'm just like, as you're talking about Pompey and Lucullus, I'm imagining like David Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal.
Yeah.
Getting stripped of their generalships and then sent home. I don't know if they're like Lucullus or like Pompey. Maybe McChrystal is more like Lucullus because he did a bunch of work to like take down the insurgency and then just gets like unceremoniously stripped of everything and sent home. I don't know if he's set up his own pleasure garden yet, but I think he's been working as a consultant making bank in DC. So maybe that's kind of close.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you don't have to build your own. It's the pleasure gardens have already been built and you just kind of can use them in that part of the country. If you have
and Petraeus certainly, Petraeus has been to the pleasure gardens. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, that's yeah. Paula Broadwell. How do I know that name? Yeah, that was the ex. She was like also an army officer or something, I forget. And he was hooking up with her. It was
Right. So I guess, you know, we've been jumping around a lot. And do you think that, I mean, is there a really quick way to just run through like a minute timeline and then get back to the sort of comparisons or the lessons?
Yeah, I'll give you the minute timeline. Okay. So Roman Republic is falling apart. The institutions are getting less and less trust. The patricians are taking more and more abuse of the people, and particularly the soldiers. The soldiers are getting more and more loyal to their commanders and less to the state itself. The first crisis was with the Gracchus brothers in the 130s. The next crisis, big one, was with Marius and Sulla, first against foreign enemies, against the Germans, and then against each other in like the 90s and 80s. Then we didn't even mention this one, but there was also a big civil war against the Italian allies. Those were the states who had been brought under Roman control, but weren't given full rights of Roman citizens. That was a civil war that happened and eventually was beaten, but the Italians were incorporated into the Roman state. And then after that, you had Pompey and Lucullus in the east. And then getting into like the 60s BC, you had the Catiline conspiracy and the fighting in the streets between Claudius Pulcher and Milo. And you had the rise of Caesar in the 50s BC, first with his consulship in 59, and with this other guy named Marcus Bibulus, who nobody knows about or cares about, who didn't do anything. And then Caesar gets assigned Gaul. Pompey is in Rome. Crassus and Pompey and Caesar are the first triumvirate. They are running the entire state, even though the form of the state still exists as the Senate being in control. The first triumvirate runs things. Crassus was important because he was super rich. He gets killed at the Battle of Carrhae in Parthia in 53 BC because he was an idiot. And that leads to the breakdown of relations between Pompey and Caesar, in addition to also
Caesar's daughter wife, dying.
Caesar's daughter dying, yes. So there we are. It is now 49 BC. Caesar has conquered Gaul. He's standing on the Rubicon, and Pompey is in Rome without a wife, or maybe I think he had a new wife who was younger and hotter. And he has the backing of the Senate, and everyone's telling Caesar to stand the fuck down.
Yeah, right. So, and then of course he doesn't, and he essentially starts a civil war. And I would also like to point out that with this, I keep calling it like schizophrenia, you know, Cato spent so much of his career attacking Pompey because Pompey was kind of like Caesar in many ways, right? He had all of this support. Like you said, one of the most important things, and you can kind of see this happening in American society. Like I remember after Trump won his first election, I was at like a family Christmas party, and you know, I'm from New Jersey. I don't want to say bad stuff about my family and my friend group and stuff, but they were really having Trump derangement syndrome, and it was very difficult in those early months and years. I'm sure you experienced similar things, to just listen to people not just say dumb things, but it's like just react to the Jewish like programming and do the whole like fake dialectic of Trump and Trump hate and all that. But I remember my one uncle, this is a boomer, He was like, well, you know, I didn't like him, but God damn it, he's the president, so now I support him. Have you ever seen Americans like that?
Yes.
And so that's kind of the old thing where, like, their loyalty was actually to the state. And even if, like, the guy, it's like, I don't like what you're saying, but I'll die for your right to say it, like that kind of shit. That is gone in the post-boomer. I mean, there might be some Gen Xers that sort of have that, but I think millennials and Zoomers, that's gone. And they're basically loyal to factions, which is, I would say, an analogy to what you said with the Romans becoming more loyal to generals, and then in the city itself becoming loyal to, you know, somebody like a Clodius or something, rather than to the Roman state as like a real entity or an abstraction of ideas.
It was just all these factions. The state didn't exist anymore. It was just all these factions fighting over the carcass.
And I was like, for us, you know, we have like the tech bro faction, you know, like the Peter Thiel, Musk faction. And there's kind of like the old, there's like older, you know, like old money factions and stuff. And it's funny, it's so similar, because if you look at it, right, Musk is supposedly, you know, the richest, or however they calculate that. It's a bunch of bullshit, right? Because it's like the present value of holdings.
Yeah, it's not like he has gold bars stacked up. Right, he just has massive amounts of debt, which in Jew world means you're rich.
Right. So, but anyway, so he's one of the richest people in the world, and yet he's kind of on the side of like this populist so-called, right? Like the Trump side. And then you have somebody like, I don't know, Mitt Romney, who is way less wealthy, but he would be more on like the optimatis side, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's fair.
So the thing about the Civil War is, you know, Cato was always attacking Pompey. He even looked the other way when Clodius tried to chase Pompey out of the city the way he did to Cicero with mob tactics. So Cato was just let him do it, you know, and just let him like prosecute basically unconstitutionally when it was somebody he didn't like. And then who does Cato and that faction turn to defend the Republic? Pompey, which is, it's just crazy. It's like if the system, if some actual revolutionary rose up and the system, the system that has been shitting on Trump and anybody that supports Trump for almost a decade now turned to Trump to defend American democracy. It's like that.
Well, that's literally what they're doing right now. I mean, it seems like that's what they're going to do. I mean, especially in the aftermath of the last election, we were all kind of expecting it to be like 2016 again with the Jewish media freaking out, but it's only like some programmed zombie liberals on TikTok who are having meltdowns, and the Jewish media is kind of like, whatever, we're going to go with it. And I think that's because they have a use for Trump now, and they're going to do exactly what Cato did with Pompey and call on him to defend the Republic against the Iranians or whoever.
Right. Defend the Republic, Israel, against, you know, and Zog against the axis of resistance or whatever. Yes. And so Caesar wins, and basically because Pompey was in the final analysis. And I don't really think there's a great American analogy for this, but something may, you know, in the events that happen in the future, something will probably come up, as it always does, to complete the cycle. But the system and its champion Pompey, and the whole thing, the implicit thing that's always behind everything, right, which is the power of force, ended up being not as powerful as the insurgent force, which was Caesar and his more veteran, more trained, more motivated, more energetic, more loyal to their general. So that's kind of what you need in order to complete this kind of revolution. And, you know, like imagine if Trump actually went to January 6th and everybody was like really tough and just beat up the police or something. And started, you know, taking like the Capitol and started, you know, and like Trump partisans started like taking military installations.
Yeah, I mean, what you would do I mean, what do you do in that situation is, you know, you capture all the police if you're Trump, and then you pardon them all and you say, I pardon you for shooting at my supporters. And you tell your supporters, hey, like, calm down. Like, these guys are your brothers. And they all like the police anyway, a little bit, even though they just had like smoke grenades shot at them. And they're like, okay. And then you establish, you know, you've like melded the two forces together now. And then you start like pushing out from there. But yeah, that's why, I mean, I don't think Trump is Caesar. I think he's a clown version of Gracchus. Cause like January 6th was very similar to the melee in the Forum where Gracchus was killed. The only difference was that Gracchus was there and died and Trump wasn't there.
I think we talked about this in a previous podcast and I said, well, Trump did die on Twitter though. Cause like they kicked Trump off of Twitter.
Right, that's the clown, the cyber bullshit fake clown world version of dying in the Forum.
Yeah, it's like the Matrix when they're like, if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life. Like, if you die on Twitter, like so, and then, you know, Caesar, I don't really remember the analogies that Spengler gave to Caesarism in former cultures. In non-classical cultures, but I don't think it's necessary. Of course, it's not necessary that the Caesar figure dies in the same way that it's not necessary. Napoleon didn't die. You know, the Napoleon/Alexander the Great figure in the turning of the culture, right. You know, the expansion of the culture and the sort of shifting of it to the early civilization phase. But if Napoleon had died, which would have been very easy, you know, he's on all these battlefields, happens all the time, one of his marshals would have completed that thing. And so in the case of Caesar, he was killed in this assassination plot. And, you know, there were a few people that could have completed the revolution to sort of end the Republican system for good and create the sort of Caesarian emperor system, which ended up being Octavian, could have been Mark Antony. It kind of was both of them. So the civil war continued with what happened to Cicero? He just ended up in exile.
Cicero was murdered in. Cicero was murdered in 43 by Antony.
Right, after being exiled. And then coming back and self-exiling again and sort of not... He's kind of plagued by indecision. He's like one of these guys. It's like, oh, do I go full establishment or full revolutionary? And he was kind of trying to like chart a middle course and he didn't like completely flee and then he just got caught and killed. Where most other people, you know, like the Cato, the full establishment. And so, yeah, the Civil War was continued and everybody thought that Mark Antony and Octavian were going to fight it out. And then they just embraced and created the seed of the Western Eastern Roman system that sort of germinated later into informal and then formal, real, different empires, and then later became the seeds for different civilizations. The Eastern Roman Empire kind of being like the Magian, more or less. And
I mean, Spengler says that the Roman conquest and holding of those eastern provinces from Egypt, Syria, and Anatolia was the pseudomorphosis was that the Romans controlled all these areas that were where the Magian civilization was starting just naturally to grow up at that time, that it deformed its development for the first like 300 or 400 or 500 years. Whereas if Antony had won at Actium, then you might have had a breakup of the Roman Empire earlier or some kind of like movement of power to the east, and then you wouldn't have had that same pseudomorphosis.
Right. Oh, yeah, actually, I guess I didn't finish the story. So at first, they sort of carved up they created like another triumvirate, like so the first triumvirate was Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus, as you said before, that fell apart when Crassus was, he was the only member that didn't have like great military accomplishments, and he died chasing them foolishly, bad tactics. And so they set up a second triumvirate. And what was the third guy? They just pushed him out eventually because he was kind of irrelevant.
It was Lepidus.
Yeah, that's right.
Who had been one of Pompey's generals in Spain, I think, is why Lepidus was somewhat relevant. But yeah, he was never really on an equal footing with Octavian and Antony.
Yeah, so Antony kind of, it was like a weird thing where he was like slowly seduced by like Asiatic culture, essentially, and sort of forgot what it was to be a Roman and started like calling himself Dionysus, and, you know, started having parties where he would literally call, you know, say that this, you know, Dionysus and Isis are, you know, Cleopatra as Isis. So he took Caesar's former side piece. And at first he just was having sex with her. And then he kind of started to feel like maybe they should create a dynasty in the Ptolemaic or even pre-Ptolemaic, extra-Ptolemaic tradition, which is of course abhorrent to, even at this time, Romans were definitely not going to accept a king by name. They would have to accept a king by fact, but by a different name. And then, yeah, eventually Mark Antony did have a final war with Octavian that he lost. Which, yeah, so the revolution was completed by somebody else, and adopted, which he didn't find out until after Caesar died, but apparently he had been adopted by Caesar legally. Octavian, I think he went by a lot of names, and he went by Julius Caesar, which I'm sure
right
is very, depending on how the history writer writes, could be very confusing. So the point is that these, in the Spengler sense, like, you know, the people, they have a lot of times historians will go, oh, do you believe in the great man theory of history? Or the, is there really like a good like name for the, like an opposing school? The kind of, I guess,
the materialist school,
the material, like, yeah, the groundswell of events or whatever. And Spengler kind of cuts through that in the sense like the great men are involved, but they're not like, there's a, something has to happen. And it will be embodied in a leader, but it doesn't have to be that exact leader. And not just for politics either, but for art, you know, like if Mozart died young, somebody else would be who we consider Mozart. And, you know, the music would be a little different, but it would be expressing the same ideas.
And it would still fit that. Yeah. It would fit that. Like there was that urge for music that was fancier than Baroque music, but not as degenerate as Romantic music. And that would be whoever, and Mozart just happens to be the guy that wrote that, but somebody else would have written it if he didn't exist.
Right. So like one lesson that we could take from that is that, you know, all these people trying to shoot Trump or whatever. Well, first of all, Trump, you know, is not Trump. Trump is no Caesar, but if somebody thinks they're going to stop a movement by killing the leader, I mean, they can certainly set it back. And if you're in the part of the cycle that's kind of the earlier part where you've got like a Gracchus type person, then killing them, getting them out of the way can really do a lot. But when you get to that point where they're like a Caesar or a Napoleon, mm-hmm. it's too late. The events are happening and there's going to be, you know, a lieutenant or somebody that's going to pick up that mantle because things are just snowballing too much and there's no stopping it at that point. The change in cultural epoch or civilizational epoch. And that ultimately, you know, we are living through that, probably. I mean, it's really hard to say while it's happening. But the biggest thing about Trump and why the thing that, that for me causes the analogies to break down a little bit is the Jewish pseudomorphosis and the idea that when you look back at these people, Pompey, Caesar, all these guys, there are things they said that were a little hypocritical, but they were. I mean, Trump is just, I mean, he is like a Clodius. He just, he, there's like no there there. And I think that's because of our culture having this fake, you know, television, you know, money thing that kind of prevents the sincerity. Like the 2016 Trump original, there was a lot of sincerity there and it just got blasted. I mean, people attacked it so much, and it's clearly, and as all that, you know, all of the you know, all the true believers that Trump tried to bring, and then they all got sniped by various people, as that was all blasted away, you saw that actually Trump was not sincere. You know, he had a sincere like shell around him that had sort of built up, you know, sort of like a one of these, like a shellfish that's like gets the minerals from the ocean, it builds its shell. And it gets blasted away, and you just see like this little shriveled thing that's just kind of talking like this, and
it's a little slug without, or a little snail without its house.
Right. And so when you look at somebody like Musk, obviously he's, I mean, I think his play with Twitter is a really good indication that he is not our guy. Like, he's very much working for the, I don't know, Jignat side, the, you know, he's a ally of Trump. But in the same way, you know, if Trump had gotten his head blown off by that guy on the rooftop, Musk would have been right there.
Musk would have been right there. Yeah. I keep calling him JV Vance, because I just think so little of him, but JD Vance, can't fill Trump's shoes, but Musk could.
Yeah, and it might be a thing where there's a figurehead like a J.D. Vance just because he's technically in office, or whoever the person who's technically in office, but the Trumpian figure, right, like would be, yeah, somebody like Musk, somebody that can rally legitimate energy. The words, it's hard to use, because you think about Caesar and it's like he was actually there. You know, he was actually on campaign. He actually went to the city. He actually delivered oratory. He did all the things himself. It's actually kind of remarkable.
How, same thing with Marius and Sulla and Negraki. Like, all these guys led troops from the front. They were at the point of danger in their lives, and that they would not have won the kind of loyalty that they had. Granted, also there was a patronage thing and getting favors for people and all that, but there was a loyalty thing too with these Romans that there isn't with Trump or Musk. You know,
well, people, there is, but it's retarded. You know,
Musk, yeah, there. I'm not saying people aren't loyal to Trump. There are many people who are loyal to Trump, but it's not the same way that a Roman legionnaire was loyal to Caesar.
Right. Or, I mean, another way to put it is the right type of people are not having the loyalty. So like you don't just need people. So if you have a bunch of idiots who will just break and flee, or they will buy the idea that Biden is like a hologram, you know, after he took office or something, you know, like those really silly who was that guy that was spreading, yeah, like Q-tard stuff. And there's this guy that supposedly he's gotten better now, but he used to share a lot of that dumb stuff, like, you know, the gold fringe on the flag and the hologram and the lights going out at the Vatican, and that's when the revolution will happen. This like really silly stuff.
I'm not in touch with the Twitter stupidity to know enough.
Yeah, when you have people like that are your loyal people, see, that's not good. What you need is like kind of grounded, sort of normal people, like a Roman legionary type person. And that's kind of not that. Yeah, that's not in the cards right now.
I thought about this problem a lot. And, you know, I think about Musk and the kind of people that he has the loyalty of, or, you know, Google, like who does Google have the loyalty of? These Silicon Valley mega corporations that are super powerful. They have, you know, Musk has a certain cachet being in charge of SpaceX and Tesla, and people will work for these Silicon Valley conglomerates in the same, almost the same way that you would for a Roman legion. Like there is a certain loyalty in Silicon Valley to the corporation that there isn't in pretty much anywhere else in American society. And someone like Musk has, or and maybe to a lesser extent, Facebook Jew,
Zuckerberg has
that a little bit of loyalty from people. But Musk, it isn't the same way as a Roman legionnaire. You have like the other thing about Silicon Valley things like Google is that they do kind of give you the full protection of a Roman aristocrat. Like they give you your food, they give you your community, they give you your retirement plan. They do all the things that a Roman aristocrat would have done for his legionnaires. And they're starting to fulfill that niche in society. But like you're saying, I can't see a Silicon Valley conglomerate fulfilling the same political function as a legion because they're not selected for on that same basis.
Yeah, well, that would I think that that's a good analogy. And I think they would be if it wasn't for the, you know, Jewish pseudomorphosis that, for example, brings in like infinity Indians and, you know, Chinese or whatever. And of course, the culture that sort of makes it like socially illegal to be, you know, racist or just like a normal guy in Silicon Valley. Like you kind of have to, if the closest thing you can be to a normal guy is to be sort of like a tech nerd libertarian, but like a Musk, basically. So you can be like, oh, I'm not for woke stuff. I'm not racist. I think that all races are the same, you know, like that kind of a thing. Or like, yeah. I'm not sexist. I think women and men can all do, they're the same. Like you have to be like,
this is all why I'm a Nazi. Like I think that the only way to break through this is to radically go against the Jewish pseudomorphosis and be openly pro-Aryan and pro-reality and pro-truth, because that is the only way. Like, the more people that go out and do that and just say, yeah, I'm a national socialist, now you start to have communities that, you know, right now it's mainly online, but there's a little bit in the real world too. You have communities of people coming together on that basis, which is going to be politically far more powerful than any of the gay shit going on in Silicon Valley or on Twitter.
Yeah, I think in the long run. The battle is to keep out the wrong and the really goofy idea, like the epistemic pollution, you know, like say, you know, COVID anti-vax stuff taking over the online right wing for about 2 years and basically replacing racial focus with, you know, it they really directly target it, because the same way that the Great Replacement was targeted by Tucker, it was changed from, you know, replacing white people to replacing Republican voters. They replaced the idea of race, because I don't know if you saw this going around, but people that hadn't taken any of the COVID vaccines, they started calling themselves pure blood.
Yeah.
You see that? Yeah. That's like a direct attack on the idea of like a racial, you know, like racial purity, for lack of a better term. Like the idea that like, oh, I'm a conservative dad, I'd rather have my daughter reproduce with the pure blood, you know, black guy who ain't take no vaccine than this white faggot liberal who's all vaxxed up, like that kind of a thing.
Yeah. Okay.
We have to, like, some, you know, people like us that are like talking into microphones on the internet, their job is like try to keep that those ideas, because that's what the system has the controls, the narrative creating machines, and they get these like shitty ideas through their proxies, you know, through influencing people, through threatening people, like, you know, whether it's like a Nick Fuentes type or whatever, like, oh no, you know, white women are the problem, like that kind of those, like that idea. Yeah. To keep those, because people will actually self-organize, and there's really, as long as you keep the poison out, there's actually a lot of talent and ability to organize. It's just the problem is that these things are all, like, even on the left, you know, they're all broken up by all these dumb ideas and false dialectics.
The poison, it is the ideas. It's these stupid ideas, like you're saying. But it's really what I keep coming back to is that it's materialism and it's money that's the problem. Whenever you have a budding movement or faction that is anti-system, it always gets corrupted by money power, money problems, money base desire for money over putting the mission first. And, you know, if you're fighting against financial power, such as, you know, we are, or even someone like Occupy Wall Street would be, you have to eliminate from your movement people that are going to grab the money. Right. And I was going to say, as far as like, you know, Jewish pseudomorphosis, if you're going up against a Jewish controlled system and you're trying to build movements against it, well, naturally, the only base of power, like morally speaking, the only moral base of power that is totally separate and cannot be corrupted has to be honor and something that is completely on, not dependent on money and not dependent on material, so that you're not getting these poisonous people and ideas coming in, like a Nick Fuentes, for instance, and then misdirecting your movement away from the real objective, which has to be to remove Jewish power entirely and set us on a different basis.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I believe that if there weren't these polluting ideas like, oh, actually the problem is white women, you know, white liberal women, they're the problem, or the problem is, you know, what, insert anything other than a lack of racial solidarity among whites and Jewish influence and Jewish power as the problem. I think that's what causes people to go for the money, because if you have the proper dialectic, us, you know, the proper friend enemy distinction, then honorable men, it's kind of an easy decision to pick the right side. But when you have all these confusing, you know, like the CIA famously, like, you know, oh, we're just going to throw so much shit against the wall, people aren't going to know what's true. When you have that going on, then otherwise good men, you know, people that could easily be, you know, they're honorable, they're good people, they're just going to go, well, you know, I just have to do what's good for myself. Or it also empowers people that aren't,
or they'll throw their energies in the wrong direction. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, I think money, you know, it's just a tool like anything else. And because of our situation, it's the biggest tool. I mean, I guess if, unless you could sort of disambiguate like media power, but they're all so intertwined. And so if we could just make sure, and I think this is slowly happening, I think on the right it's happening with the continual discrediting of the people that say dumb shit. Like every time, you know, of course I would wish that everybody who believed the dumb shit, they see it's dumb, like 2 weeks until mass COVID vaccine die off, they would stop believing the people that said that in the first place. But every time that happens, it's like they lose 10% or something. Like then some of those people can be captured by a real message. And then on the left, I would say they're having, you know, they're falling apart, which is great because so many of their people are waking up seeing the actions of Israel. And yes. I, so it could take a long time. It's impossible to know whether, you know, we're in their Gracchus situation, the Mario Sola situation, or, you know, obviously it's going to play out differently in Western civilization than classical.
Eventually these Jews are getting thrown out. Like, I'm confident of that. And it's not just because, it's not just because of the pseudomorphosis thing. It's also just because, like, in Rome, you had the same phenomenon where financial power was dominating the state from, you know, the aftermath of the Second Punic War until Caesar. And it was the same two forces at play. It was financial power versus military power, right. Sword power versus purse power. And eventually, the financial power, which has to survive on this subversion and trickery, eventually abuses people so much that people turn to open violence. And that's what we're seeing more and more of, and what we have been seeing more and more of in the West in the last like 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, in the cosmic sense, you know, the Jews can't win because a parasite can't defeat its host. You know, the host can evolve a defense, like the good outcome, right, is that the host, through, you know, natural selection or whatever, comes up with a way of expelling the parasite, and then the parasite's gone. That's the good ending. The bad ending is they both die. But either way, the parasite can't perpetuate forever.
Yeah, especially a parasite like Jews, who have to keep growing. They can't just stay like... They can't just keep control over the golem body of Western civilization and keep themselves at the same level. Like, they have to keep stealing more and more land, more and more wealth, and bleeding us dry. So, yeah, like, it isn't a stable – there is no stable relationship between Jews and Aryans. Like, it's either we all die because they take over too much and the civilization just collapses, or they're expelled and the civilization lives free of them.
Right. So, yeah, I think what we're going to be seeing is, like you said, with the Luigi thing, the establishment, you know, the Catos, if you will, are going to be shocked at how little of a shit people that are like 40 and under give at, like, you know, CEOs
it's been
or
so, it's
whoever
been
getting
so
killed.
Great.
Yeah.
Just watching the reactions, because, like, yeah, they're parading this guy down the street with, like, surrounded by goons in stupid sunglasses and carrying their low ready carrying their ARs or M16s or whatever, and it's just like, you guys look like such fucking tools and this guy looks like a hero, and girls of the internet are throwing themselves at him, and it's, you know, the lesson is that, yeah, nobody gives a fuck, Cato. Like, you can come out and say, well, we need to have law and order. It's like, well, you're in charge, guys. You're the ones who are creating the situation that's causing people to get killed in the streets. Obviously, nobody wants, like, mass murder or, like, anarchy in the streets, but you're the ones in charge. You're creating the social conditions that are leading to this, and you're trying to blame fucking Luigi? Come on. It's ridiculous.
Right, and the social
and
conditions
sees it, and it's great.
That are the broken deal that we were talking about before. So the elite... Like, the Jews are aware of it because they're smart, but, like, you know, the dumb kind of, like, goy shills that perhaps even believe in liberal democracy or whatever, they're in for a rude awakening because
believe in the 18th century.
Yeah, they are unaware that it's not just, you know, that everybody's just going to pull out a gun and start shooting people, but it's going to start being like, I mean, it already is, like, people do not. You know, whether it's people making it, like, every young person making the joke, I would never fight for Iran, like, LOL, I'd rather cut my leg off or something.
You can't imagine this happening 20 years ago, like either the Luigi assassination or people, yeah, saying like, fuck that, I would rather shoot myself in the foot than, like, go fight against Iran.
Yeah, for Israel, a lot of them say, which is...
For Israel,
like, bonus points. So I think we're in the social conditions where, yeah, the system is bankrupt and people are just pointing to the system, like the system's rules, and they're not respected. And we're in this revolutionary, that's the environment, you know, the revolutionary environment. Yeah. So I don't know what the Gallic legions are. I don't know what the what that situation could become. You know, the Silicon Valley obviously makes a certain amount of sense, but there's not so much that any one person can do, but I just think at the very least, like if somebody says some dumb shit, like, oh yeah, the problem is, you know, whether it's the Nick Fuentes thing or the, any of these like Twitter Jews, you know, where they kind of say like, Aryan stuff. And that's why Israel's cool because it's killing brown people. You know, they're trying to like trick, you know, just that.
So we have to kill the Third Reich by blowing up Russians in the Donbass or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That stuff, just make fun of it. You can certainly engage in like debates about it, but if it's just online, just make fun of it. That's the way, like, to be Clodius about that stuff. Like, just make fun of it. It's gay. Like, haha, you're gay, you're Jewish. Like, even if you know the person's not Jewish.
The only thing you don't, make fun of is powerful Jews. Like, you don't make fun of Larry Fink or, you know, the Palantir CEO, Alex Karp. You don't, those guys are fucking evil. And that's like, that goes back to Adolf Hitler's thing about, you know, you don't make fun of an enemy because that dissipates the fighting power and the will to fight of your troops. If they are going up against a hardened aggressive enemy and they expect him to be a weak little sissy, now the propaganda service has prepared its men improperly for the fight they're facing. But other than that, like that one caveat aside, I've been thinking a lot about humor lately. And yes, humor should be employed against those stupid, ridiculous ideas, as you're just saying.
Yeah, yeah. Like a ruthless ridicule of the ideas and kind of the Shabbos Goy type people. And then, yeah, but like a inhuman demonization of the enemy. Which they are providing.
They've already been doing that to us for decades, so it's fair enough. Like they call us terrorists and shit, so fuck you.
Absolutely. Know? And they are providing the material in this, you know, action on Gaza and elsewhere. Do not let that drop. Like if anybody says anything about Nazis or anti-Semitism, just, you know, it's like point to the sign, you know, and it's like pictures of like the dead Gazan babies, like just beat them on the head with that and make them
you keep saying Nazis this, Nazis that. Yeah, I see like Palestinian babies being liquidated with U.S. taxpayer dollars at the behest of fucking Jews. So let's talk about relevant things, Jew.
Exactly. So and in an environment like that, where the left is, or like the Jewish parasite on the left is demoralized by just the reality of Jews and that they're not actually champions of human rights for everybody or whatever the lie is there. And the right is demoralized by just showing that, you know, people like Trump are just taking money. They're just kind of, you know, who's the Italian, Maloney? They get elected saying, oh, we're not going to have African migrants. And then I think they just got rid of diaspora Italian citizenship, like it used to be if you have like an Italian grandparent.
Oh, you know, really? Shit. I guess I missed out on that. Fuck.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if it's fully gone through yet, but they're basically they're targeting that instead of targeting what the Italian people actually give a shit about, which is not being flooded by third world black and brown bodies of color. They target, you know, they say, oh, we're going to cut down on immigration. And the first thing they go after.
To be fair to the Italians, like, I wouldn't want the Costco, like, Sicilian peasant family coming back to Italy either. You know what I'm talking about? The Costco Twitter obnoxious New Jersey people. Ugh.
Yeah, you know that main that Costco.
I'd rather Jewish than right? Africans than those people.
But you know the like the main Costco family, like the social media, they're Jewish. You know, like the boom. It's like a stupid thing, but yeah, they're like Jewish Italian or whatever.
I guess I should have known that, but it's every fucking time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Of course it's.
But yeah, you're right. But, you know, on the other flip side, I don't think there's a lot of like Jersey Boys or, you know, Jersey Shore types that are going back to Italy. I think if somebody's an American Italian and they want to go back to Italy, they probably are a higher quality person. But
look at the Italians in America who are famous right now. There's Luigi Mangione and there's Daniel Penny.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like
people that I'm sure Italy would be happy to take back, or at least most Italians would.
Yeah. You know, everybody was saying Daniel Penny looks like, they said he looks like, because, you know, they were saying he's like Northern Italy and then Mangione is like Southern Italy. I actually think there's this old sculpture of a German by the Romans. And I think Daniel Penny actually is like a dead ringer, because with the curls, there's this famous facial bust. So I think he's probably got some significant admixture. But yeah, exactly.
Italy is a petri dish of different European ethnic groups. I mean, people, I'm from Southern Italy, I'm from the very, very south, and people, you know, I don't look like an Arab. I look like a Norman, for instance.
Right. Well, you're also half German.
Well, there's that too. But, you know, I assume that my ancestors were Normans. And if not, then we were Greeks. So whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Six one, half dozen the other. So
yeah, I was going to say on the right, or you're saying the left wing, this is like a huge opportunity for us right now. And I don't think everybody's seen that yet. Like, people after the election are still like, oh, conservatives this or whatever. The opportunity right now in terms of propaganda and spreading the truth and getting people to understand what they need to do is, I think, with the left, because these people, the left is now, first of all, there's the Palestine thing. They're starting to see the Jew problem. Second of all, they're the ones who are out of power and they're the ones who are disenfranchised. The Jews have started moving all their money and assets over to the right. So now the people on the left are like, well, fuck. And granted, a lot of these people are Antifa fucks who are evil, but there's a lot of people who aren't Antifa evil fucks. So there is opportunity here. I see it. There being great opportunity for bringing these people who are now on the outside of American politics over to the true side, which is, you know, National Socialism, to fight against Jewish power. So, you know, and after the midterms or after the next election will be the other way around again. You're going to get all the conservatives are going to be out of power, and it will be time to go and preach the evangelical truth to them rather than the left. So I'm an evangelical Nazi. I am willing to preach to anybody to get them to understand the truth of Jewish power and make them do something about it. So, yeah, any last thoughts, Roman, about Caesar?
Yeah, I would say a classical lesson we could take in this time is discipline and knowing when to strike, when to, you know, gamble everything on a single throw, when to hang back. And what you were just saying about who to preach to, something that online right-wingers, not all of them, of course, but the younger they are, the less experienced, the more Nick Fuentes type, it's difficult. There's also, you know, being online without real facial interactions and stuff, it makes the social interaction so weird. People get triggered. Don't get triggered. Keep discipline. If you are having a political, like, it might feel good to say something, like if somebody's like, well, I think this, and you're aiming to like make them look stupid, like, no, aim, think about it, engage in the discipline of not letting, you know, your neural circuitry just go to like the easy, think about what's the correct political thing, whether it's a joke, whether it's a serious.
No, here's the distinction here. You don't agree and amplify. You always reframe. The only time, like if someone says to you, they say some outrageous thing, you reframe within the context of the National Socialist worldview. And you point out Jewish power, and then you work from there. Jewish power, Jewish responsibility, everything follows from that. What you don't do, the one time that you agree and amplify is if somebody says, oh, what are you, a Nazi? You say, yes, I'm a National Socialist. I think Hitler was awesome. If on a matter of identity and what you believe, you say, yes, I'm a National Socialist. That's, I guess, a qualified degree and amplify, right? But on pretty much everything else, you reframe. You morally reframe, because if you don't reframe, then you, if you agree and amplify and you say, oh, fuck niggers, or like, I'm a fucking racist, hell yeah, now you've given up the moral high ground. You've actually made yourself weaker, and you open yourself to further attack.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's certainly some situations where you shouldn't just say, yes, I'm a Nazi, like, for example, at work. But I know, it's like, obviously, if you're having a discussion with people that can't, you know, that's not like a dangerous thing to say.
I'm not giving you economic advice. I'm giving you rhetorical advice. You apply it to your economic situation as necessary.
And I just think I just want to like hammer the idea of discipline, that people get online. They get online for dopamine. If you want to be a political person, then that's not what you do. You know, you have to choose one or the other. Is going online entertainment, like, you know, playing a video game, or are you trying to do something political? And, you know, people can diminish it and say, oh, well, it doesn't matter anyway, I'm just having laughs. Well, okay, fine. But if you want to be a serious person, if you want to make a difference, then have discipline in how you talk to people, even if it's your family. Just, you know, your family you have a lot of history with, you might feel an emotional trigger if, you know, you're in a social situation and they say, oh, what are you, one of those dumb Trump supporters or something like that. Just think about, you know what their priors are, you know something about their psychology. Really think about what you're going to say. And this is very important to maintain that discipline, especially now when you can get like these dirtbag left people or anti-woke left or whatever they call it, they're very vulnerable.
I wouldn't use the word vulnerable. I would say they're persuadable.
Right.
But the good ones. I guess if you're talking the bad ones who can't be converted, who are just absolute shills and disgusting people, like, yeah, they're hit them with all the humor that they deserve and just wreck them by all means. But the ones who, there are people out there who can be persuaded and should be persuaded.
When I say vulnerable, I mean like their Jewish programming is vulnerable right now.
Yeah.
Like, and so go after it. Don't go after the person, you know, like it might feel good. Oh, ha, 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 your candidate lost. Like, no, that is the worst. Right. That's very, very bad. It's just a selfish.
It's just reinforcing the Jewish dichotomy between left and right is all you're doing.
Exactly. And, you know, just when you read these histories, you can see that there are many times when somebody like a Caesar or even a Cato, you know, they probably didn't want to ally with certain people, and or they didn't want to hold their tongue about something or whatever the situation is. But, you know, they, in particular in Caesar's case, you know, there were alliances and things that he did. He saw the bigger picture and he kept discipline. And when he was backed into a corner and he had already invested so much and built himself up, then he took the big, you know, plunge and the big chance. You don't just take the big chance. Like if you're some 20-year-old guy at work and you go, I'm a Nazi and I think all of you should be too. It's like, you don't have any social capital. You don't have anything. That's not a good way to go. You do something like that, you know, in a more eloquent way when you have built up a lot of trust in the situation that you're going to deploy that.
That's a good point. Well, Roman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on. And to all of our listeners out there, Merry Christmas, Happy Yule. Again, this show is for, especially for all the people who don't have anyone to be with on Christmas and you want to be with your community. Well, you know, we are your political community and you are our political community. So thank you for joining us this Christmas. Merry Christmas and Heil Hitler.